Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is J.J. French. He was a founding member of the band Twisted Sister. He's out with a brand new book, Twisted Business, Lessons from My Life in Rock and Roll. And J.J., as we jump into this, Twisted Sister, as we know it, was about the 11th ideation, you say, of that band. And we always hear about the intersection of art and commerce. And so you write a lot about that in this book, not necessarily in those type of words, but how busy is that intersection of art and commerce where you're the artist, but you also have to worry about a business?
Yeah, well, first of all, the music business consists of two words, music and business. And most musicians don't think about the business side of it. And I've always thought about the business side of it, always have, because how many stories exist of the musician that winds up broke 30 years later, 20 years later. Hey, man, I didn't know what was going on. Hey, man, you know, I never bothered to look. Hey, man, I just asked to get some money, and they gave me some money, and hey, man, and that kind of stuff. So I've always had this attitude that there's three kinds of people in the world, the people who make it happen, the people who watch it happen, the people who go, what happened? And I was never going to be in the group that goes, what happened? I was either going to make it happen or watch it happen. So, to your point, I was always aware of that intersection of art and commerce, and I wanted to make sure that I was a gatekeeper at both sides.
What part of the interesting story to me of Twisted Sister is there's so many bands that have been successful, and there were none more successful, really, than Twisted Sister in its day, but you guys play the minor leagues a lot. I mean, you spent a lot of years in the minors together trying to get this band going. How much of that all aspect of your band was attributable to how well you guys meshed as a band and as a business?
Thank you. It's a great question. The fact is we spent so many years in the minors that we learned every trick in the book in the minors. So when we were eligible to go up to the major leagues, we had already done most of the stuff. I mean, we already had figured out how to be our own merch company, our own record company, our own promotion company, our own production company. We already knew relative sizes of PA systems that you needed for rooms that you played in. We knew how to make independent merchandise and make records on our own. We knew how to promote because we used to have to promote ourselves on radio locally. So we became really good at all of it. And, you know, the more you do something, the better you get at it. And it started off so small that it really kind of gave us a shot. I mean, you know, the old story, you play in front of 20 people the first time. It's true, you know, and then you slowly build up to the point where nothing becomes a shock any longer. So while most young bands find it hard to believe about the world that we came out of, because the New York City bar scene or the tri-state area bar scene was so special, drinking age is 18, and there's thousands of people who wanted to come to clubs, but the clubs started out small, 200-300 people, but the clubs got bigger because more people were going, and so we got a chance to expand with the rooms. So by the time we were signed to a record deal, we regularly were playing to sold-out rooms of 3,000 to 5,000 people. We've done outdoor shows over 20,000 people. We've done it a lot. So that jump wasn't as drastic as it would be to a lot of other bands who kind of just out of nowhere kind of fall into it. We had already had years worth of acclimation.
The Twisted Sister act, it's a glam band, you know, transvestite type of costumes and stuff. And I always think it's interesting when you watch a band like Twisted Sister or Kiss or any of these bands that play costumes and have characters in them. Those characters are so detached from the reality of the musicians and the business people behind them. How is it that the music industry is able to keep that so separate for the fans to watch? I mean, it must just be a hell of a good job you do, because none of us really think of musicians as business people.
You know, I think Gene Simmons has made a point of telling people, hey, I'm a business guy. Now, maybe he's been too much of that, to the point where there's a cynicism built in because it seems it's just business, it's just marketing, it's not the music. We've never been that. We always thought it was the music or the impact of our show. But, you know, there's anyone who succeeds in this business long-term, you have to have enormous respect for them because it's a very tough business to last a long time in. And if you've lasted a long time, that means you've learned a lot of lessons. So I don't care if it's the M&Ms and the Madonnas. I don't care if it's music you don't like. The point is you're a survivor in a very tough business. You deserve to be there because you have learned the lessons that you've needed to learn, and you've also learned how to evolve with your fan base, which is another whole issue, too. It's like knowing your market, really understanding your market. One-hit wonders don't have that. I mean, it's going to be fine. There's a world full of one-hit wonders. But, you know, Twisted Sister, this December, will be celebrating its 49th year of existence, and I take a great deal of pride in that because it shows that there's a vision there and a dedication, and the fans drive it, and you work really hard to keep that connection.
Well, you have the We're Not Going to Take It song, and everybody knows that from Twisted Sister, and I think you even write in the book that you can go anywhere in the world and start playing that drum beat, and everybody recognizes it. It's kind of like a Hotel California is for the Eagles, and maybe a Rock and Roll All Night for Kiss, but when you first heard that song, when Dee Snider wrote it, when you first heard that song, did it sound to you as if this could be a hit? I mean, does it ever have that it factor for you as a musician?
To understand that song is to understand Dee's songwriting, because Dee is an amazing songwriter, not to mention a phenomenal lead singer. But he had this penchant for writing anthems, and it started out in 77 when the band first, or 76 when the band got a house together and started rehearsing in the basement, and he came up with a song called I'll Never Grow Up Now, which was our first independently released single. Very anthemic, because I think he loved Alice Cooper. Alice Cooper wrote big anthems, you know, like I'm 18, Billion Dollar Babies. These are just gigantic anthems, and School's Out. So he liked that aspect of heavy rock. So he wrote this song, I'll Never Grow Up Now. And then the second anthem he wrote was Bad Boys of Rock and Roll, which became the second single. And then we released an album called You Can't Stop Rock and Roll, and that is an anthem. And on that album was a song called I Am My Me, which became our big single in England, and it's what broke the band in Europe. It didn't really happen here, but it happened in England. It's a big anthemic song that people all sing in huge crowds in Europe. And so when he comes up with We're Not Going to Take It, at the time, it was an extension of all that history. I can't say I sat there and went, it's any greater than these other ones. And the irony of it is that England, the country that broke us, the president of the label in England, the chairman of WEA, didn't like the song at all and refused to promote it. How's that? That's kind of crazy. If you think about how important that song is in the band's history, they wouldn't release it as a single in England because the guy went, eh, nothing special. So, I can tell you this. The nexus of Twisted Sister and MTV cannot be denied. The nexus of its importance cannot be denied. And what you have here is the video was the right video at the right time. And essentially, that's really what made that happen at the degree that it happened.
I'm talking with J.J. French about his brand new book, Twisted Business, Lessons from My Life in Rock and Roll. You grew up in the Upper West Side, I think Upper West Side of New York, or at least in New York City, and you had an upbringing where you kind of went through a lot of things, but one of the stories I love in the book is about you listening to WABC radio and the Top 10 Countdown and not realizing how that works. Can you share that story of how you got a lesson in how the Top 10 Countdown worked?
Yeah, so I'm like 10 to 11 years old, homesick, bored to death. Asked my mother to give me a radio so I can listen to the radio. She hands me this tabletop radio, and I turn it on, and I happen to turn on WABC, which was the number one station, not only in New York, but the number one station in the nation, 50,000-watt clear channel on a good night, 9 states. But I don't know any of this stuff, you know. So I'm listening to the guy, and he goes, number one. It was a song called Hey Paula, by a duo called Paul and Paula. I know nothing about the music business. It's number one. I don't even know what the hell that means. But, you know, they're playing the hits. So it's the top 10 singles. And back in those days, when you play the hits, you play the same top 10 singles all day, like every hour, on the hour. You know, and you count them down. Even though it's top 20, it's really the top 10. It's the same over and over and over again. So I'm listening to the radio. I'm kind of blown away. The song Hey Paula is number one. And then bingo, following week, there's a countdown. I decided to listen to the countdown show. I don't know what that means. And the charts change, but Hey Paul is number one again. And then another week goes by, and the chart changes, but Hey Paul is number one again. This goes on for 6 weeks to the point where I am thinking, wow, I guess the world has a number one song, and that's really great. And who's responsible and why? And I get really puzzled by this, but I am convinced that Hey Paula is the official number one song in the world and will likely be that for the rest of my life. And after about 6 weeks, it gets knocked off of number one, and I was just floored. I was blown away and very disappointed. I demanded to know the answer. Why? And told my mother, and I would keep saying to my mom, the song is number one, and why? And she's like, are you serious? Like, you know, don't you... Maybe you should be reading a book and, you know, you're homesick and you should be, like, studying. She was kind of not happy about it. I kept saying, I got to know why the song is number one. So she convinces me to go to a record. I convince her to take me to a record shop, and she takes me to a record shop. I tell the story, and I walk into a record shop for the first time in my life. And, frankly, it was the beginning of my addiction of rock and roll. I was so blown away at this record store. I was like, my eyeballs opened up like, you know, like Wile E. Coyote. It's like, oh, my God, oh, my God. And a little old lady is standing behind the desk, and she's selling 45 singles because albums really weren't a thing yet in the history of pop music. It was still 45. I mean, there was albums there, but I think West Side Story was the number one album, the musical. Anyway, I say to the woman, could I have this thing? Could you have Hey Paula? How much is it? 49 cents. And if I said, if I buy it, will it go up, back up to number one? Can you imagine what this woman is thinking? He's a 10-year-old kid. And he goes, if I buy it, will it go back up to number one? And I think, you know, she wanted to tell me, it's run by the mafia, you idiot. Don't you know how this works? It's called payola. Like, you know, but she went, you know, she said these words to me, maybe. Like, that was it. That was like, you may as well have been a gambler at your first horse race, you know? Like, oh, my God. So I became addicted to the music business from that incident. And to this day, I can put Hey Paula on. I have the album now. I lost the single. I can put the song on, and my heart goes back to when I was 10. And that was 10 months before the Beatles hit. So then the Beatles hit. And, of course, there's always there's this thing about being the music that you fall in love with between the age of 12 and 20 is the music that sticks with you for the rest of your life. It's been said. I've said it, but I've read it in other places. Well, I had the Beatles at 12, and they disposed of us when I was 20. So that means I luckily grew up in a period where I had the Beatles in real time, and the Rolling Stones in real time, and the Who in real time, and Zeppelin in real time, and Pink Floyd in real time. So to grow up in the 60s and be a hippie, as I go into the book, was a luxury because we had the greatest music, and we were able to see the greatest shows, and that's what fed my addiction to rock and roll.
You're done with the Twisted Sister as far as live performances now, it seems. And so as you go home and look at your collection of things, what's the most precious piece of memorabilia you have from your life with Twisted Sister?
Oh, man, you know, you ask really good questions. No one ever asked me that question. You. Maybe the backdrop from 1976, which was recently given back to me by a fan who was given to him by one of our sound men who died several years ago. And he gave it to this woman named Karen, who I've known for years, and she said, you know, I've got the backdrop from 1976, the hand-painted backdrop by Rich Levy. I'd like to send it to you. So she sent it to me, and it's mounted, and it's going up on a wall. It's like a nice, it's a big backdrop, and it's just an art piece, and that's good, and the original drum head. And there's a lot of that. I mean, there's the guitars we played back in the early days and the first singles that we released. And, you know, I mean, the book is the book, essentially, because it is a half of a memoir and a business book, the Bizwar. It's a business book and a memoir, the world's first official Bizwar. I cover a lot of ground, as you know. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of ground that gets covered. And every piece of that ground that gets covered is important in my life and has had a heavy-duty effect in my life all the way through to the business portion of the book, which is the Twisted Method of Reinvention. So there's physical things, for sure, and then there's the lessons learned, which are equally as valuable.
I've always said that experience is the best teacher, and I've had people point out to me, experience of others is the best teacher, and boy, you have experienced it, and now you're able to share your lessons that you've learned with all of us. The book is Twisted Business, Lessons from My Life in Rock and Roll by J.J. French. It's available now everywhere your books are sold. J.J., just a fantastic bizwar, which I thought was a fantastic read between the memoir part and the lessons you learned business-wise, and I thank you for joining me to talk about it.
Thank you. I hope that people understand that it doesn't matter what kind of business you're in and all what kind of music you play. These are lessons that work across the board in terms of what it takes to really make it and to sustain a career in light of, you know, competition and just the struggles that one has to go through. I hope people are really entertained by it, and I really appreciate you having me on the show. Thank you very much.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.